Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 18th. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from January 17th. Representative Lehman moves approval of the minutes from January 17th. Any discussion, changes, corrections, additions, subtractions, or edits? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. So, members, today what we're doing is we're hearing from some Minnesota utilities. First on our list is we have CenterPoint Energy. And the topic of today's items is Minnesota Energy Past, Present, and Future. And I believe we have a copy of your presentation right here. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, members. My name is Adam Piles, Director of Regulatory Affairs with CenterPoint Energy. So you should have a copy of this presentation in your packet. And just for those of you who don't know, CenterPoint Energy is the largest natural gas company in the state. We serve over 840,000 customers in about 260 communities around the state. And what I'd like to do today, we're going to talk about three things in the time that we have available. We'll talk a little bit about natural gas supply and delivery. It's important for you to hear that information because the next two topics are related to that. Then we'll talk about natural gas prices and the next big thing in natural gas. So on slide four is a map of the United States that shows natural gas basins, and it's labeled the lower 48 states shale plays. So in the natural gas industry, you may have heard about the shale revolution, the increase in natural gas supply. It's all related to drilling in the locations shown on this map. So there are a couple of these basins that you've probably heard about. The first is the Bakken in North Dakota, and the second is the Marcellus in Pennsylvania. The Marcellus shale play has really transformed the supply picture in the natural gas industry. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So this is where the natural gas is. And then in slide five, what has this meant? It means we have about 105 years worth of natural gas. This is a big change from where we were 10 years ago in this industry. It's all related to, primarily related to, discovery of natural gas in these shale formations and the increasing productivity of natural gas wells. It's technology driven. It's related to the fracking issue that you may be familiar with. So on this slide, five, we have about 100-year supply of natural gas. So slide six is talking about, okay, that's where the gas is. We have 100 years worth. How does it get to where it needs to go? It travels through this network of pipelines to bring gas from the producing area to the consuming area, from the production area to market. And then on slide seven, you'll see a diagram of the state of Minnesota and a pretty crude rendering here of these are the pipelines that come into Minnesota. These are the ones that bring gas to our state. You may be familiar with some of these if they're near your districts. So we have the supply side. It's an abundant supply. We have the pipeline network to bring gas to market. The next part of the question is pricing. What does this mean for prices? On slide nine, this is a graph from the Energy Information Administration. It shows two pictures of prices on natural gas. The blue line, or the line that shows the highest peaks, is the monthly price of natural gas. The line that shows the less volatile, more squared off peaks, those are the annual average prices.
Now, are these inflation-adjusted numbers, or are they just what the price was at the time?
Price at the time. And so here's the takeaway on this. So what people used to talk about on natural gas is that the price was volatile. You can see that in the 1998 through 2008 period in the peaky line. You see some spikes there in 2001, 2003, 2006. But after 2008, those spikes get fewer and shorter. So one of the complaints about natural gas in the past used to be volatile pricing. That is much less the case today. Okay? That's an important point for us to think about going forward. On slide 10 is another way to look at that. Here again, you see the monthly prices. A couple of those historical peaks have been identified and attributed to hurricanes. So in 2006, we had two hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico that interrupted natural gas supplies. We saw a spike in the price, the monthly price of natural gas. In 2008, there was a run-up in commodity prices that affected natural gas. And then more recently here, if you remember January of 2014, polar vortex, we saw a spike in the spot price and the monthly price of gas. But the reason I wanted to include this slide is the line that is what's marked under the futures column from 2017 forward. This is what the financial market estimates the price will be in the future. And you'll see that it's trading in the range $3.350 for the next, well, through 2024. That's what the futures market was saying in December. So, okay, that's the wholesale price of gas on the supply side. Nationally, on slide 11, so how did the prices in Minnesota compare to the prices around the country? This chart shows that the upper Midwest actually is in the lowest price band shown on the graph. So regionally, we are doing well compared to the rest of the country. And the prices shown here are for residential service.
Well, if I may ask a question. So as I look at this map, you mentioned the Marcellus play before, and there's all that abundance of natural gas, yet we see very high prices in the Northeast United States. Could you just explain why is that?
Right. So the one of the impacts on the Northeast is the pipeline map that we looked at, right? So it's a capacity. It's how do we deliver the gas to market. Northeast United States is a very high-demand market. It needs a lot of natural gas. There's constrained pipeline capacity to deliver gas to market. That's primarily the answer for the Northeast. So that's the regional view. How does Minnesota compare to some of our neighbors? That's also discussed on or shown on slide 12, where we have another little graph that tries to say Minnesota is the bar with the square marker on it. And if you're working from black and white copies, you may not be able to tell, but Minnesota is lower in price than Iowa and Wisconsin, slightly higher than North Dakota. North Dakota is a producing state, so they have some production in North Dakota that could lower their rates.
And is this the y-axis here? Is this dollars per MCF?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yep. So for the most part, Minnesota is in pretty good shape compared to our neighboring states. We're in pretty good shape compared to the country. So what does all that mean? The next big thing in natural gas. How does any of this fit together? And on slide 14, for CenterPoint Energy, the next big thing is infrastructure investment. Okay? Over the next 5 years, our company will invest about $1 billion in the state. And what that means, perhaps for you folks, is there are hundreds of jobs that are attached to that investment. There will be millions of dollars of tax revenue generated by that investment. And the purpose of all of that is for us to continue providing safe and reliable natural gas service. Okay? So $1 billion investment for a company like ours, that's a big thing. The last point I'll mention here as a potentially big thing goes back to the slide on abundance. So we have a 100-year supply of natural gas. The question is, how will we choose to use that? Okay, I've put down a couple possibilities here. One is electric generation. One could be transportation. There is talk about exporting natural gas to other parts of the world where it is trading at a much, much higher price. Those are all possibilities. And the last slide, or the last chart on that slide 15, is just a little graph that shows you how the gas is used here in Minnesota. And about 8 to 10% of the natural gas is used for power generation today. Industrial use of natural gas is actually larger than residential use in Minnesota. So that's just a kind of an interesting fact that you may not have seen before. So my takeaway message for you folks today is there's plenty of natural gas. Infrastructure is important to get it to market. Minnesota is positioned well from a competitive standpoint, and the industry produces jobs and tax revenue to benefit the state. That's all I got. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and right on time. Any questions and comments from members of the committee? Representative Scott, and then Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I grew up in Iowa, of course, and so I see down in Forest City, there's a Forest City Basin. Is there anything going on with that right now?
The testifier?
Yes. Thank you, Chair and Representative. Forest City Basin has been identified as a potential play. There's not a lot of exploration going on there today. It is included in the 100-year supply projection as a possible source for additional production. But to my knowledge these days, there's not a lot of drilling going on in that basin right now.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sir, you mentioned higher prices and infrastructure constraints in the Northeast. The trend seems to be in the electric generation to go to natural gas. Is that same thing happening in the Northeast with their situation with supply?
Some other speakers today may have more current information on that, but it's my understanding that you are seeing a shift or a desired shift from other fuels to natural gas in the Northeast. There is this transmission constraint problem that has to get solved. The Northeast U.S. is a very difficult construction environment, either geologically or for density. Right? It's much more expensive and difficult to construct in a dense metro urban area.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the testifier. Given the shift in usage from coal generation to the natural gas generation, that added consumption, is that going to add to the price for residential use of natural gas?
So the price of natural gas is going to be affected by many things. It's primarily a supply and demand market. What we're seeing is, yes, it's true, there is more natural gas being used for generation, but there is diversity of fuel supply in the generation fleet, right? So natural gas is picking up some of the coal retirements, but there are other sources of generation that are doing that as well. So as far as the impact on residential prices, it's possible, but today we have 100-year supply. As the demand increases, that supply will come down. There will be movement in the price. Where it will be 10 years from now, 15 years from now, is hard for us to tell. The financial markets are saying it looks flat for the next 5 years in the 3-350 range.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this for the testifier, and then maybe for the testifiers to follow, just a little heads up. I'd rather not be redundant, so if you could include an answer to my question in your presentation, that would help to speed things along. I'm curious to know, you know, in the electrical world, we refer to transmission and distribution. I'm not sure what that parlays into the natural gas. I'm curious to know how many miles, I mean, you show your, what I would call, transmission pipes here. How many miles total do you have of transmission and then distribution out to your customers,
right,
throughout the state of Minnesota? And one little caveat, the Central Pipeline up in northern Minnesota, it's a great place to hunt deer.
So in terms of mileage, the analog on the gas side, so electric transmission distribution, it may be helpful to think about the interstate pipelines as the transmission provider. For the most part, that's what all the miles are of pipe. And the distance is whatever the distance is from the origin of that pipe to the market. So if it's 1,000 miles from the Texas coast up to Minnesota. That pipe's 1,000 miles. Within the state of Minnesota, CenterPoint Energy, we do have some pipe that is classified by the federal government as transmission pipe, and that's less than 100 miles. We have about 14,000 miles of distribution pipe. That gives you an idea of the scale.
And Representative Fabian.
Yep, just real quickly, I'm curious to know, other testifiers too, just what the impact to local counties and townships and schools in terms of property tax revenue that's generated from your facilities.
Well, I believe just very recently, maybe in today's paper, there was an article that mentioned the top property taxpayers in the counties and various cities around the country, or I'm sorry, around the state. I know that CenterPoint is up there, so we are perhaps the top property tax provider. And I was told shortly before the meeting earlier today, in one of the cities or one of the counties, our property taxes were $300,000. As an order of magnitude. So it will vary depending on the density of the facilities that we have, the size of the county, those kinds of things.
Representative Sundin, Neuberger, and then we're going to move on to our next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Up in my district, I've got more pipelines going through there than I have constituents. But so pipeline safety is always a great concern. We've got lots of problems with the oil pipelines. Could you share some comments about your safety record with gas transmission?
Sure. Thank you. So pipeline safety, for us in the gas industry, this is the number one priority. Right? Providing a safe and reliable service is the number one thing that we do. Our safety record, we believe, has been very, very good. You don't have some of the same impacts on a natural gas leak that you may have on a liquids leak. Right? So the concern on the oil side, of course, is contamination of soil and water. Natural gas, it's a very different situation. In terms of what companies are doing about it, the federal government has issued several rounds of regulations in the last 10 years in response to some high-profile gas safety incidents, and companies like ours are investing to comply with those regulations. So a portion of the billion-dollar investment I mentioned is absolutely directed towards pipeline safety changes and improvements.
Representative Neuberger, you get the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Piles, thank you for coming on this afternoon. The question that I have is, approximately 20 years ago, we were told that, oh, my gosh, we're out of gas, and that it's a dying resource. Then technology improved, and now, according to your presentation, you're saying 105 years. Is that an amendable number contingent on technology and undiscovered resources, or what is this? Because they're looking at, to me, the information that I've gleaned, for lack of better words, shows more than 105 years. So could you touch up just briefly on that,
Mr. Powell?
Yeah, thank you for the question. When we talk about 100-year supply of natural gas, you're absolutely right. That number is subject to revision. Since the 1980s, I've watched that number go from 20 to 50 to 100 to 50 to 20 to 100. So it does cycle through. It is driven by technology and end-use application. Right? So if, for example, as a country we decided to export quite a bit of natural gas, our consumption would increase and reduce the amount of supply or the number of years of supply. But it is subject to revision, as you understand. There are technical improvements happening all the time in the drilling space, and that can affect these numbers.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate it. Next is Minnesota Energy Resources. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And I believe we have a copy of your presentation as well in our committee.
Thank you, members. I'm Amber Lee with Minnesota Energy Resources. And just to get us off the gate, Adam Piles just spoke about the wholesale side of rates. I'm going to take it and make it focused on the residential and the local distribution company. So rates that are charged here to customers in Minnesota. Real quick, as an introduction, Minnesota Energy Resources is a WEC Energy Group utility. So we do LDC work here in Minnesota, but our affiliates do electric and transmission work in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan as well. So when we get to the comparison of rates, we're borrowing from those jurisdictions where our affiliates reside. Merck is about a third the size of CenterPoint. We were first founded in 1932 to serve the Rochester area. That's still our densest service territory. We also have a large contingent of customers on the Iron Range where we serve gas to the taconite facilities. We have approximately 230 employees in Minnesota, about 230,000 natural gas customers, over 184 communities. You can see on the slide of Minnesota that our service territory is very spread out across the entire state. CenterPoint, by comparison, is centralized in the central part of the state and the southern, but we reach all four borders. So today I'd like to just explain the two components of the LDC residential rate and offer a comparison of the rates here in Minnesota and also regionally, and then just let you know where we think our rates are going. So on this first slide here, you can see that currently the rates are currently split between the gas cost and the distribution component. So the LDC rate breaks down with those two components. We have the gas cost and then the distribution cost. Currently, you'll see in the year that we're showing here, 16 to 17, it's about an equal split between the distribution and gas costs. If you go back to like 5 years ago, that would be split much higher. The gas would be about 70%, 60 to 70% of that rate. Adam was showing that gas costs have generally steadied, and we're expecting them to stay readily, basically steady in the next few years. So we expect that this will break down similar to what we're showing here, about a 50-50 split. The residential gas cost comparison is offering the rates of the five gas providers here in Minnesota. Merck is on there three times because we have three different operating utilities or zones within our company. But you'll see that the gas cost comparison for these five are relatively similar, and we're taking only a very narrow bandwidth between that 37 cents a therm and 42 cents a therm.
For members of the committee who don't know, can you define what a therm is for them?
Well, it's the one unit of gas, and it would be similar to the MCF, and a decatherm would be the same, if that helps. Well, it's the unit of measurement, and we bill in therms. So that's the usually if you get your bill, it would be billed in therms.
Exactly. Please continue.
The distribution cost also is just running that narrow bandwidth between 32 cents and about 37 cents per therm. So that is also very consistent among the five companies here in Minnesota. Then we bring out the spectrum to the four neighboring states. And you can see that.
Can you just tell us what slide you're on as you go to it? So
yeah,
so
you're I'm in. Sorry. I think I'm having I have the wrong number, but I think it's about slide 9.
Okay.
It's slide 8. And slide 8 offers the comparisons of prices among the four neighboring states. So this is Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. And you'll see that again, it's still a pretty tight bandwidth between the 33 cents per therm and the 43 cents. And this is for the last year. When you get to the distribution among those four states, you see it does begin to split a little, and you have all the way down a range from 17 cents to 61 cents. This would be slide 10. You can see that the residential cost in Minnesota just for the distribution, the gas cost, just for the gas costs, has been volatile. So again, this is where you get back to we're relatively split between the two components of the rate now. They're about 50-50 between gas and distribution. You can see that the gas cost component of that was the volatile component, because the next slide, slide 11, shows that the distribution cost has been relatively steady. I would say relatively steady, trending slightly upward, and I know that my company is projecting the same sort of growth on those distribution rates. And that gets us to slide 12, and this is where we're projecting our rates to go and why. Historically, we've been investing about $20 to $25 million in Minnesota, just in our capital investments. We expect that to double or triple over the next 4 years. And the questions are, well, why? Why do we keep having to increase the rates? Because we'll probably be going in for a rate case every 2 or 3 years at a minimum. And the real reasons are we need to do a lot of technological improvements, automatic meter reading, gate station monitoring. We need to do system integrity projects like the Rochester distribution build-out that we have pending at the commission now. And we need to do a lot of relocation for public improvements. And we think that we will be spending, again, double or triple in the next 4 years, mostly around those three drivers. And then just one other slide quickly to let you know what else is on the agenda for our company this year. We are going to be addressing the safety issues with our farm tap customers. We have about 1,700 of those who have direct taps into the transmission line that runs through northern and southern Minnesota. And then we are going to be working again on our expansion projects using the new area surcharge mechanisms and possibly the new gas expansion rider, and we'll be looking for areas that we can use that.
Thank you. And can we get your contact information so if members have follow-up questions, they can follow up with you?
Sure.
You just give that to the committee legislative assistant, that'd be that great. And then with regards to the Rochester expansion, just one question. So 2 years ago, the legislature passed and the governor signed a proposal to allow to incentivize energy infrastructure expansion, and now, there's been a little bit of a problem with that before the Public Utilities Commission. Can you just kind of update us on the status of that and why that hasn't been, or just kind of update us on where things are at right now?
Certainly. And you're speaking of the natural gas extension rider, the 216.
Yes.
Yes, so after that was passed, MERC submitted an application to the Public Utilities Commission to use that rider for our Rochester expansion project. We filed in November of 2015. We're expected to be heard at the commission in March of this year. That was a little bit of an unusual project for the commission in that it's a very large investment for our company. So the process was, I would say, slow as we work through this kind of unique filing and the first filing under the rider statute. We have also, MERC has applied for the use of that rider for our expansion projects in ESCO and Ballaton, and we will be heard at the commission on those tomorrow. So we are hopeful that tomorrow the commission would give us an approval to go forward with both of those expansion projects.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And again, if you could share your contact information with the committee legislative assistant, then we'll go from there. So thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is Xcel Energy, Mr. Rick Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Rick, you look so much younger than last night.
Chris Clark subbing in for Rick Evans today. I'm president of Xcel Energy Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. It's a pleasure to appear before you today. I'll just go through the PowerPoint, give you some highlights about who we are at Xcel Energy, the size and our presence in Minnesota, and then some of our plan, how we see the future along with the rate analysis that you asked about. So the first slide here about Xcel Energy provides that overview and gives you some of the key statistics. We have almost 9,000 employees and contractors. We're proud to be part of the communities that we serve. Our employees volunteer, and our foundation and our employees give generously. We're also Minnesota's largest taxpayer, and so that is part of what rolls through the utility bill to our customers at $192 million approximately a year. And we're a large spender, in addition to being an employer in the state, spending almost $700 million. We have about 1.3 million electric customers and about half a million gas customers. This next slide, Powering Minnesota's Energy Future, just highlights some of the things. Oh, before I go on, we have about 85,000 miles of distribution lines. Those are the lines that you see connecting residential neighborhoods and to your home. And about 20,000 transmission lines, those would be the miles of transmission lines, those would be the larger big structures that you see. Those connect the substations, about 350 substations and 15 power plants across our Midwest system here, and about 12,000 miles of gas pipeline. So on to Powering Minnesota's Energy Future, one of the things that we do, of course, is listen to our customers, and they're telling us that they want clean, reliable, and affordable energy. We're also in the midst of a major transition of our fleet. A lot of our building occurred in the early 70s. We had power plants that were older than that we've already been in the process of converting. But you'll see in a couple of slides we lay out where we are with that transition and what's coming. As we move forward, we, of course, want to keep our costs competitive. We have a great opportunity to invest in new technology, and we're taking advantage of the great price on renewable energy that we're seeing. As we make changes to our existing fleet, we also want to continue to be a good presence in the community. So we've been focused, when we make a change to a plant, on trying to encourage economic development as part of that. And I won't go into detail here, but I do want to mention that on the distribution and wire side, there's a tremendous opportunity to incorporate technology into the grid. We want to be very careful about how we spend money there, because you can spend money in a hurry, and we want to make sure we're bringing value for customers. And, of course, there are cyber and physical security issues that need to be addressed with that. So this next slide, our plan, just outlines where we are. We outlined in a filing we call a resource plan that we filed with the Minnesota Utility Commission, a broad plan to begin the transition of our fleet. This included adding a significant amount of renewables, nearly doubling what we'd have on our system, adding a natural gas plant at Becker, and closing two of the older coal units there, Sherco 1 and 2. This is a picture of Sherco 1, 2, and 3 here on the slide. Sherco 3 at 900 megawatts is one of the largest in the country. Sherco 1 and 2 are a little bit older at about 700 megawatts apiece. Our plan will help reduce emissions. And we'll also be affordable, because we're making the transition by adding resources in a sustainable manner that really fits what our customers can afford. And the final piece, of course, is we've committed to continue operation of our nuclear plants. We had extended the lives of those to 2030 for Monticello, 2033 and 34 for Prairie Island, and we're committed to continuing to run those. Nuclear industry, as you may have seen nationally, has faced some challenges, but it's a great baseload resource, and it is carbon-free. This next slide, baseload fleet transition, really shows you the largest power plants on our system. These are the ones that we depend on for the majority of our energy, and you can see here we've listed the dates when those plants are expected to retire. Of course, Sherco 1 and 2 are part of what we rolled out in the plan to make those closures. But then next you see the three nuclear plants reach the end of their lives in the early 30s, and our King plant over on the St. Croix goes to 37, and Sherco 3, that large plant I pointed out, goes somewhere between 2035 and 2040. One of the reasons that we've decided to continue with our plan to close Sherco 1 and 2 is we want to have an orderly transition for our customers. That's important to the cost that impacts our customers and also for our system planning. If we were to put that off, we end up stacking all of our major generation resources to retire in the 2030s. And while that might make my job easier now, it's not really the right thing to do for the next generation coming or for future leaders of our company. This next slide, Upper Midwest Energy Mix, shows you what our portfolio looks like in 2015 and where we're headed in 2030 with that plan that we laid out. We're at about 35%, 34% coal right now. By 2030, that'll drop down to about 15%. You can see the increase in wind and solar. Also, we increase natural gas. A lot of times I get asked what the other category is. The large portion of that is a Manitoba Hydro purchase that we make for about 500 megawatts. That expires during the period of our plan. When we have a power purchase contract that we haven't extended yet, we simply show it going away. It tends to get replaced by gas resources. We will work to see if we can get a good price from Manitoba Hydro, and if so, would likely include that as part of our mix going forward. One of the things I'm really proud that our company has been able to achieve is to have a nice diverse mix so that if we see a spike in one commodity price or another, we've managed it for our customers so that doesn't all flow directly into their bill. We're being careful not to go too heavy in natural gas, but fracking has brought great prices for natural gas, so we want to add the right amount to keep our system reliable. This next slide, economic value of wind energy, I like to just give folks a sense of what's going on in the wind energy market. We've seen a tremendous maturing in the wind energy. Both the manufacturers and the developers that do these projects, the turbines have gotten better, more efficient, taller, and really take advantage of the wind resource. And at the end of last year, the federal government extended tax credits, the federal production tax credit, which has really put wind on sale. So as we make the transition, we have the opportunity to add wind for our customers at a price that is undercutting coal, gas, and other resources on our system. So it's a great time to add the wind to our system, and we're excited about the opportunity to do that and do it in a manner that's cost-effective. And we call this strategy Steel for Fuel, and you can see on this next slide, I show you the relative production cost by resource type of the different generation resources we have. And the current wind prices are absolutely amazing in that $15 to $25 range. Now, we want to add this sensibly to our system, and that's why our plan includes adding the gas plant at Becker. The gas and wind work well together to provide energy for our customers and keep the overall system reliable and let us continue to make the transition as we retire the coal units. You can also see large-scale, what we call utility-scale solar. So this would be, 100 to 200 megawatts field full of solar panels. The price continues to drop at an amazing rate there. And so we do see the potential of solar. By 2030, we expect solar will mix it up with natural gas. You can see solar is starting to knock on the doorstep of the nuclear costs. And that's in part because of all the pressure we've had from the NRC to make the necessary investments for safety and reliability in nuclear. I've listed some of the other costs there, and you can see biomass was an interesting idea but very expensive. And community solar gardens, while they're attractive for a lot of customers, are certainly much more expensive than the utility scale.
Mr. Clark, just a quick question for you.
Sure.
From an environmental or emissions perspective, what's the difference between a new utility-scale solar development and a community solar garden from an emissions and environmental perspective?
So obviously solar we like to think of as an emissions-free resource, but it certainly has a land impact, and a lot of communities are working through how they want to write the siting regulations for solar projects. A Community Solar Garden, as designed by the legislature, was intended to be, we argue, a 1 megawatt project, so relatively small. The commission, in exercising that, worked with the other solar developers, let it go to 5 megawatts. Now, that's still going to look relatively large, but you don't get those economies of scale that you get with a much larger facility. As you get to 100 megawatts, you're going to use a lot more land, and so those land issues become much more important.
So from a ratepayer and value perspective, we see that solar gardens are substantially more expensive than utility-scale solar. What do your ratepayers get as a benefit out of that for paying those higher costs?
Well, the argument is that there is an overall value of solar proposition and that these more distributed solar projects will cut down on the need for some of the infrastructure, those large transmission lines, and maybe even some of the distribution systems. And that's the argument for them. We certainly also get a benefit in learning how they integrate into the distribution system. I am all for innovation and experimentation. We just want to be careful how much of higher cost resources we have when we have cheaper resources available. So we like innovation and experimenting. We want to be careful that we keep the overall affordability part of the equation as part of the mix.
Representative Thiessen.
That raises a question just for me. So what goes into production costs? So are you counting those kind of savings and you're going to avoid distribution costs? What is a production cost?
So what we're showing here, because the way community solar gardens will flow into customers' bill is we provide a bill credit at a rate that's been set by the commission. And it depends which customer's getting the credit, if it's a residential customer or a commercial customer, but it tends to be 12 to 15 cents. And so that's the driver of what we put here for the production cost, because the production of that solar facility is going to have that 12 to 15 cent a kilowatt hour cost to our customers who are paying through it through the fuel clause.
Now please continue.
So can I just
more
broadly, aside from this, that what counts in production costs?
So what we're really
talking about, this is like a very basic question, sure, as a new member of the committee. So thank you.
We're taking the generation that we get from that facility and the costs that it costs to produce that over the hours that it produced the energy. So that gives us the range per megawatt hour. For production that we get essentially through a power purchase agreement, that represents the production cost. We're trying to represent what it effectively is costing our customers on a megawatt hour basis.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay.
I can give you a formal definition, if that's helpful, Representative.
That's great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please continue.
The next page, I just wanted to give you a sense of how our retail rates stack up against other investor-owned utilities. So this, we tend to benchmark ourselves against other investor-owned utilities because they tend to serve metro areas in addition to some rural like we do, and tends to be the right utility to benchmark against for our competition. You can see we tend to land in the middle here where that middle line is our Minnesota state Xcel Energy cost. If you're to break this out by class, you'll get differences. So one of the things we've been concerned about is that our industrial rates have in some classes started to slip above the national average, where our retail residential customers have stayed well under the national average. So one of the things we've been doing is trying to make sure that we're staying competitive for our large commercial and industrial customers, important to attracting new business and retaining business for economic development. Finally, I just wanted to highlight that we do have a lot of customers coming and asking us for things. We have both communities and customers from Walmarts and the Targets, the 3Ms, many others who've adopted a corporate sustainability goal, and so we're excited to be able to offer them things that we think will help them satisfy those goals, green up more of their energy supply, and have little or no impact on other customers. One of these we call Renewable Connect. We have a Renewable Connect government that the state of Minnesota has been very interested in. We also have energy efficiency programs, which are excellent for helping our customers really use our product to help their business be successful and helps the other customers avoid power plants. We've avoided approximately 10 medium-sized power plants with our energy efficiency. So it's good for the system, and it's good for the particular customer. I appreciate all the time, Mr. Chair, and I'll stop there and tell you I really appreciate the opportunity to appear today.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Great presentation. Not as good as Mr. Evans does, but it's pretty good. So,
I'll keep working on my game.
So we're going to take two questions because we do have to get on members to other testifiers. So we'll start with Representative Mahoney and then O'Neill.
I'm trying to stay away from my seatmate here who's coughing up a storm. He's going to get me sick, and I'll have to miss, and I won't be able to enjoy the rapport with the chair.
Keep coughing, Cal.
I got two questions. Do you see much more that you can get out of the conservation? I'll just leave it at that. And then the other is, when did you start noticing that shift that you spoke to about the difference between residential and business costs?
Sure. We do think there is more to be obtained in conservation. We do think it's going to be harder. One of the things we talked about, we do our conservation programs in three-year programs. We're currently in a three-year program. We think as we come out of this program, it's probably the right time to step back and look at where do we want to go, how do we want to spend the money, how do we get the most bang for the buck in what we're spending of customers' money to keep going. Seen tremendous gains in lighting efficiency with LED. We do think that there are custom programs that our largest customers could benefit from. Those tend to be more complicated, and the cost of the program then can start to eat into the benefits. And so there are some challenges that we think are worth working through. We do think that we've had great success with conservation. We think there's more potential, but it is a cost that goes into customers' bills, so we want to be careful and thoughtful as we go forward, and we're very open to reflecting on how we spend that money. The second question you had was on the business and residential. Yes. We've been focused over our rate cases on making sure that each of the groups of our ratepayers is paying the shares that they drive for our system. And there is a bit of a subsidy that flows from industrial customers to residential customers. We've had good success working through the commission process in eliminating or reducing that subsidy. But we have noticed over the last 3 to 4 years that our industrial rates have started to slip above the national average. Not a lot. We still think we compete well. But I don't like seeing Iowa undercut us, because then that means a business could be tempted to move. And we have seen businesses that operate multiple facilities come and tell us that, you know, our third shift is moving to another state. And so those are, you know, yellow to red flags for us that we really need to go back in and focus on where we can take costs out to stay under that national average.
Just a quick follow-up. Yeah, Representative Mahoney.
In the last jobs meeting, I guess the Energy Committee meeting, we kind of opened up the RDF to new spending. And would you be interested in joining a discussion about where that RDF money could be spent to make some of these larger conservation projects on industry and help industry stay in the state? I know that's a big concern with our chair on jobs committee.
That's a good idea, Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're certainly interested in any discussion about how to help attract and retain business in the state, and we want to play our part to help Minnesota be successful.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have about three questions, but they're very brief.
Go.
Okay. How much solar are we adding in your? How much solar are you adding in your next resource plan?
In the plan that we just finished, we estimate that we'll add between 600 and 800 megawatts of the smaller community gardens. So that's a fairly substantial amount of solar community gardens. I would actually like to add some of the larger utility scale projects, because the price point is coming down. And I think if we could get one or two of those large projects on our system, we better learn how to integrate that large resource. I'd rather have 500 megawatts or less of community solar gardens and a couple hundred megawatts of large solar projects that are put in over the next 10 years than All of that going into one bucket. I like that diversity that we talk about when we do our resource planning. We think we'll hit 8 to 10% solar by 2030.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. And so that 8 to 10%, is that, I thought I saw a resource plan that had about 2,400 megawatts of solar. Is that about what that equates to, the 8%?
We'll double check that, but I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay. So then on a ratepayer's bill, how much of that bill is due to the biomass that's required that you purchase, the community solar garden, energy, and the RDF, which are all things that we have required you to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can give you the breakdown. I think we have a chart that shows elements of it. I don't know the community solar garden component off the top of my head, but we're clearly over 5% of our large customers' bill on that. And when you add the community solar garden that we're expecting to come on the system, you'll be moving significantly above that 5% mark. So we're at the point where it is noticeable, we think, to those energy-intensive customers. Probably less noticeable to residential customers, but it is there.
And the biomass, if you add that?
I included the biomass in that 5%. I think biomass and the renewable development are costing our customers about $125 to $130 million a year.
Wow.
Okay. Representative O'Neill?
And then the last question is, so you have in the other category, a lot of that is the Manitoba Hydro. How much of that, of your percentage of your portfolio, is biomass, since we're paying so much for biomass?
Well, biomass is a relatively small amount of our portfolio. We have 110 megawatts that came out of the biomass mandate, and we have a facility that's a converted coal plant in Wisconsin that co-fires with wood, so technically that gets classified as a biomass, and then sometimes the garbage burners are classified as biomass, sometimes not, but you're in the 100 to 250 megawatt ballpark for biomass, whereas Manitoba Hydro is about 500, and then we also have a slew of relatively small hydro facilities over in Wisconsin that get put in that other category as well.
So, Mr. Clark, thanks for your testimony, and as always, if members of the committee have follow-up questions from Excel, Mr. Evans and the other members of the Excel staff are available. Well, they're available when they're here and sober, but, you know, that's beside the point. That's a joke. Come on. Good Lord. All right. So next
off
up.
The record,
yeah. Well, thought it was a funny joke. I guess not. Note to self. No jokes. Undertale Power. Lauren Locktug. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and
Thank
continue.
You, Mr. Chair. I'm Lauren Locktug from Undertale Power in Fergus Falls. Members of the committee. And you have a non-color version of my slides, I understand.
Yes.
A low-budget operation. I thought, just as background for the committee, I'd explain that Otter Tail Power is the smallest investor-owned utility in the state of Minnesota, and we are a part of Otter Tail Corporation. We do have some other owned companies who are in manufacturing and plastics. We those are held under the name of Veristar, but I'm here today to talk to you about our electric platform on the left. I thought the quickest way to do this would be to use a map. We do business in three states as Otter Tail Power. And in those three states, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota, about half our customers are in Minnesota and half are in the Dakotas. We serve 422 communities in three states. The average population is about 400 people. And in those three states, we have about 800 megawatts of owned generation. We actually co-own two coal plants. The Coyote Station in western North Dakota is a lignite coal plant. It was built in 1982. The Big Stone plant in South Dakota was built in 1975. It is a sub-bituminous coal plant. And in Fergus Falls, the Hoot Lake coal plant is also a sub-bituminous coal plant. It was built, finished in 1962. The Hoot Lake plant is our oldest plant and will be retired in 2021. We have combustion turbines in Jamestown, North Dakota, at Lake Preston in South Dakota, and Solway near Bemidji in Minnesota. And we have both owned and leased wind farms at Langdon, North Dakota, Laverne and Ashtabula, North Dakota, and we recently announced a wind farm that will be southwest of Jamestown, North Dakota. So, and we have altogether about 5,400 miles of transmission lines in those three states. So I thought it would be useful to update you on, we do a rate case. Investor-owned utilities all have to do rate cases to prove their costs if they want any additional funding for anything that's different or new. And in February, a year ago, we requested a 9.8% increase in our rates, which is about $9.50 a month for our average residential customer. The drivers are new environmental technologies to clean up coal facilities, for example, strengthening our delivery systems, in particular transmission system additions. And our costs and current rates were based on 2009 costs, and those have obviously changed since 2009. We expect the Public Utilities Commission will rule on our rate case in March of this year. I thought it might be helpful, especially after yesterday's conversation, to talk a little bit about what we call the regulatory compact. I heard the word monopoly tossed around a couple of times yesterday in pejorative terms, and I think it implies to some people monopolistic behavior and monopolistic pricing, and I can assure you that's not what it means in the context of the regulatory compact that utilities function in. There exists a compact historically between the utilities, their customers, and their regulators. Utilities are afforded, yes, monopoly service territories, but the purpose for this is to avoid wasteful duplication of service and duplication of assets. There were days in the 20s, 30s, and 40s when utilities of various sorts were on top of each other trying to build lines and plants to lots of people, and that was obviously a waste of time and a waste of money and a waste of anybody who was paying the bill. So as a nation, we just decided, let's give monopolistic territories and say, this is the area where you serve the customers. Again, this was for the purpose of avoiding duplicative assets. In exchange for this, customers receive the efficiencies of the economies of scale that come from owning assets in mass by and for all customers. In exchange for a monopoly service and for inside the regulatory compact, utilities are obligated to several things. First, they're obligated to provide service to anyone who asks for it. There are probably some customers who we might choose not to do business with, and I've worked in offices where I listened to people who were probably people I would choose not to do business with if I could help it, but we do business with everybody, and we make arrangements with everybody, and we do the best we can to keep the lights on for everybody. We are obligated to provide what I'll call socialized rate tariffs for all customer classes. Mr. Clark referenced customer groups. The regulatory term is classes. There is a residential class, there's a small commercial industrial class, and a large commercial industrial class. We're obligated to provide socialized tariffs so that there's no preferential treatment for anyone inside those classes. Finally, utilities are obligated to deliver safe and reliable service, and to ensure that that happens, both voltage and hours of interruption are monitored and reported on a regular basis. Finally, the third part of the sort of triumvirate, if you will, of the regulatory compact is utility commissions. Utility commissions are obligated also to do these things. First, to ensure just and reasonable rates that are based on actual cost. And second, to make certain that assets deployed are what we call used and useful for all the customers over the life of those assets. And finally, they do afford a reasonable return on shareholder capital that's invested in utility assets. So I hope that's useful background for understanding a lot of conversations that will take place in this committee during this session. Remember what's called the regulatory compact that exists among customers, their utilities, and the regulators who manage and oversee rates. The last thing I'll show you is a chart of our retail rates. This would be a lot better in color. Unfortunately, it's in black and white on your page. The line at the top is the national average. And I'll just summarize. These are our average retail rates for all classes. I'll summarize by saying this. In 06, our average this is for three states. That's why there are three lines. In 2006, our average retail rates were a little above 6 cents. And in 2016, they're around 8 cents or just above. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I've got for today. Thank you all.
And members of the committee, what we're going to do is I'm going to make sure that we have staff for the contact information for all our testifiers will be shared with the members of the committee, because we do have four other presenters, and we'll make sure to get the your contact information included there as well, Mr. Logan.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next is Minnesota Power. And my favorite University of Minnesota Regent is also who the testifier is. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record. And
thank you, Chair Garofalo, and members of the committee. Dave McMillan, Executive Vice President of Minnesota Power and Senior Vice President of External Affairs for Elite, Minnesota Power's parent company. And I'm relishing the opportunity to talk about megawatt hours rather than Gopher sports. How's that? So. I like the Gophers, but I'm tired of talking about it. So, what I want to cover today is a quick look at Elite. There's not that many corporations that are New York Stock Exchange traded and headquartered north of Hinckley, and we're one of them. So, and most of our businesses are energy connected. Talk quickly about Minnesota Power and its footprint, our unique set of customers, which are very unique, generation fleet transition, how we're doing in the environmental front as we transition that fleet, a little quick look at our strategic priorities as we go forward, and then close with what my colleagues have closed with, historic and some comparative pricing information that gets at the all-important competitiveness issue. So slide two, the map here. Elite is the parent company of the five companies you see there. Just a quick snapshot, Elite Clean Energy is a business we launched in 2011. And it's grown to about to own now about 550 megawatts of wind projects. You can see in the little inset in the upper right there where we are across the country. That's an unregulated business. It sells to regulated utilities like Xcel and others, but that's one we thought was a good one to get into. And it's proven to be just that. And we've developed a big project for MDU in the last year, and we're looking for more of those kinds of opportunities. We developed expertise in wind out in North Dakota as we built Minnesota Power's Bison Wind Farm and thought we'd go and try and deploy that around the country. And we've had some success doing so. Out in the middle of North Dakota, we have BNI Energy, a lignite mining operation that mines about 4 million tons of lignite a year with some of the very, very lowest delivered fuel costs of any type of fuel anywhere in North America. That those plants there, mine mouth plants, produce power for Minn Kota and a shrinking piece of our power portfolio, which I'll explain a little bit later, but an important part of our business, an important presence in the energy-rich and energy-policy-friendly state of North Dakota. And you see the transmission line there coming in. I'll talk about that as well. That's our DC line. Superior Water, Light, and Power, a small utility across the harbor, distribution utility with some transmission assets. It's a wholly owned subsidiary of ours. It is a little miniature version of Minnesota Power in that the petroleum industry, refining and pumping, Enbridge and Calumet make up the vast majority of their load over there. And into Superior and into Duluth comes the American Transmission Company, which isn't listed on here because it's not a wholly owned subsidiary of ours. We're a 9% owner of that transmission business over in Wisconsin, but they also hold some assets here inside Minnesota. That's an important part of our overall business. And then lastly, in our newest acquisition, U.S. Water, out in St. Michael, 450 employees across that upper left-hand corner inset gives you a sense of their footprint. They provide water and wastewater solutions and energy solutions for industry and commercial customers across the country. We're pretty hooked on the energy water nexus. You can't have energy without water. You can't have water without energy, and that's what drove us into that space. Again, that's not regulated. Switching the page to slide three, our footprint. You see that is our 26,000 square mile service territory. We obviously don't serve all the geography inside that.
We serve the major load centers in there, and the major industries, our partners and friends in the cooperative and public power sector, supply a lot of the retail service in there, but that's where our transmission lines and our control area is, and gives you a sense of that geography. About 1,200 employees. For Representative Fabian, you see our numbers there on the transmission and distribution lines, so we tend to look at Titch more like a co-op than like our friends at Xcel, because we've got a pretty rural service area. But outside of Duluth, Duluth is our one urban core, and that translates not just transmission, but all of the property we have, the utility property in the state, to about $37 or $38 million a year in taxes. So we're not number one, but we're up there a ways in that property tax in terms of being a big payor in Minnesota, a lot of host communities, and that's important stuff. We've grown from 5% renewable in 2005 to we closed out 2015, crossing over that 25% marker on a capacity basis for where we get our power. And that does not include any of the power we purchased from Manitoba Hydro. That's our wind and in-state hydro. We're the largest producer of hydroelectric power in Minnesota. And our company's origins start with the Great Northern Power Company, which was built around the Thompson Hydroelectric Facility that I think a lot of you have toured in Jay Cook State Park. Importantly, we don't talk about this much, but we serve 16 municipalities, stretching from Piers down by Little Falls up to White Lakes and Bowabic and Brainerd and Grand Rapids, big and small municipalities alike. They buy wholesale transmission and generation service from us, and then they distribute it themselves under a municipal model that lots of you are familiar with, but I don't know that you know we serve that many of them. So we also partner with cooperatives, both at the rural electric level and at the G&T level. In fact, a couple really unique deals we've done with co-ops over time. We built the Milton R. Young Station, number two, with Minn Kota back in the 70s, and that was unique at the time to do something like that for an investor-owned utility, and the big 465-mile DC line that connects that plant with Duluth. So we've been creative, and in the early mid-late 90s, we partnered with Great River Energy to build a wholesale power trading business that we headquartered over in the Grain Exchange. The demise of Enron led Wall Street to make sure we were no longer in power trading, so we exited that business. But, again, I think a really interesting way to do business across business models. Slide four, the pie charts there. Here's the unique customer mix piece. You see us on the left. You see an average utility like the couple that preceded me here. Those aren't their numbers. That's a U.S. average, but typically the commercial, industrial, residential split is closer to a third, a third, a third. For us, it's over 70% industrial, and then that residential and commercial slice. All customers in the residential and commercial space benefit from the presence of big, high load factor customers like Kiewit and Taconite or Mintec or Bland and Paper or Sappy. They use power 24/7. And they help us lower the average costs on our system pretty significantly.
So one quick question. Will be
yes, sir.
The only question we're going to make you get, so Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that 25% of your power supply comes from renewables, and then you also mentioned that you get quite a little bit of power in from Manitoba hydroelectric sources. Why isn't that included in the renewable resources?
Chair Grofflow and Representative Sundin, it's excluded by law, anything larger than 100 megawatts imported from Canada, and that has a long history that I won't try to recount here, but at some point it is renewable, and we think it should count, so let me leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McMillan, but who created that law?
I think the testifier and the representative knows that all laws are created by one and one person only. No, obviously the legislature passed that. So,
Chair Garofalo, I don't honestly know. I can take it back to the early 90s, but I'm not sure. So, anyway, moving on, you can see on slide five what's driving us today. We'll take advantage of market opportunities as long as we can. The market for wholesale power is very attractive right now for buyers. At some point, that's going to change, and when that changes, we're going to need to add some natural gas combined cycle capacity that matches up very nicely with wind, and we're going to continue to, you'll see us adding wind. We're in the solar place as well. We got a 10-megawatt plant up at Camp Ripley, a very unique partnership with the Department of Defense. We'll look for more of those, but I would say wind is where you're going to see us doing more additions. And our two biggest units at Boswell 3 and 4, remain critically important baseload resources that enable renewable energy deployment across the system. Switching to slide 6, you've got the point of this one is, and it's a little tricky, not in color, but basically the blue is what was going on in 2009, red in 2011, and so on to the current point. We've reduced across that SOX, NOX, particulate matter, and mercury space all the way over to the far right there, almost 90% reduction. What's left is largely CO2, and without more science and major engineering, we're going to have a hard time getting at that, but we are proud of the results we've gotten at our flagship station there at Boswell, having invested about $600 million over time and really rebuilt those plants from the ground up. They're good to go through 2035 for Boswell 3 and through 2049, I think, for Boswell 4. Switching to slide 7, strategic next steps for us, looking at how we transition this fleet and do it in a manner that's responsible economically and environmentally. We'll look to run those newest coal units as long as we can and benefit our big customers and our small customers alike. We've taken steps to close our smaller plants up at Taconite Harbor. We're leaving that one mothballed while we make sure that MISO is ready to go in case something goes wrong with the power grid. We've converted our plants up at Aurora Hoyt Lakes to natural gas. There are peakers there, and the next step we'll be taking, as I said, more wind. It is very cheap, but you can't add it forever because it's got to be complemented with another resource. When the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, you can't make paper at Blandin Paper, so we've got to have resources out there. That's why we probably are looking at a combined cycle plant sometime in the, I'd like to say the distant future, but it may be nearer. Again, we'll watch that market, and we will locate a natural gas plant where transmission and fuel source, talking back to Mr. Pyle's presentation, where there's multiple lines, good source of water, and friendly jurisdictions to do it in. So I don't know where that's going to be, but I think you'll hear us talking about that over the next 3-4 years. For now, I'm going to lean on that power market and do the best I can for my customers. Big transmission investment, and I'll wrap up here quickly. The Great Northern Transmission Line starting this month. A lot of you in the room were helpful in getting us that put over the finish line. When we connect that line to Manitoba, we will increase our renewable generation another 11%. So I told you we're over 25 today. On a given day, that can be 28, 29% on an energy basis. We'll be buying 383 megawatts from Manitoba when we finish that connection. That puts us up in the beginning to approach 40% range by July of 2020. We're proud of that, and we're really proud of the fact that it is the single best technology to match with wind. As my Canadian friends say, if we get through the permitting process, get the Great Northern Line project built, we can use Lake Winnipeg as a battery, eh? So I've learned well from them up there, and they're great partners. But the reality is we can take the wind generation and literally use it when it's there, and when it's not there, we call on the Canadians for more power. We've got to have that electrical interconnection, but we can balance the two on an hourly, daily, monthly, and yearly basis. It is a storage opportunity that I think Elon Musk is a long way away from matching at that scale. We're state leaders in conservation. I switched to slide 8, pushing 2.5% sometimes. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't say that's going to get hard to continue to find that low-hanging fruit. Projects get more and more expensive as you get into farther up that pyramid that you see on the right. We're going to keep doing our very best in that world, but it's going to get trickier as we go forward. Closing thoughts around price competitiveness, moving to slide 9. You can see this is 2 decades back, and the blue line, or you don't see blue, the flatter line is the consumer price index, about a 2.2% increase between 95 and 2015. And for the first decade there, you saw us performing better than the CPI. as we put the capital investment into the transmission and the generation system. We've seen some bumps there. 08, 09 was a series of rate cases, which Mr. Lautau just talked about. We flattened out again. We've made some more capital investments, and it is the slope of that line that concerns me the most in my role as a senior executive of Minnesota Power. We have to make sure we're keeping track of that. Mr. Clark talked about that as well. We have to be a competitive provider, or we're going to do damage to industry. I think that line's flattening out for us again. Another driver in there was the expiration of a major legacy rail contract with the BNSF. If I can make an unscheduled editorial comment, that is a monopoly business where their regulatory solutions aren't quite as good. So we were at their mercy, and we saw some big increases at the tail end of last year that affected that. Last slide, slide 10. What you got here is commercial industrial. That's high load factor, bigger loads that think of a foundry, that kind of load. And you don't have the coding here in color, but the first bar, 8.4 cents, that's upper Midwest investor-owned utilities. Second bar is Minnesota Power, and the third bar over is the Minnesota investor-owned average. So that's the way that works all the way across. So you see our rates just under 9 cents at that commercial industrial level. A typical commercial office shopping center where the load factors aren't as high, approaching 9.5 cents, and then our residential is just under 11 cents. And what I did not put on here is our large power prices. That's the class of customers who have 8- and 9-digit bills, and I don't exaggerate it, 9 digits. Two of my customers pay 9 digits a year for electricity. I'd like to think that's a quantity issue, not a price issue, but it's a big, they're very, very big, important customers. Some of them are in the room or their representatives. I don't like to show that number in public because it varies a little bit by each one, but if I had it on here, it would be in the 6.5 cent range today, roughly speaking, across the entire class. That's where we stand, and we're proud of the fact that we're the lowest investor-owned utility cost here. Against the municipals, it's all over the map. Our residential prices are right about in the middle. Some are below, some are above, and against most of the cooperatives, we're below their prices on the residential and commercial side as well, sometimes by significant amounts. I don't say that to brag, simply to give you the working basis you need. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and we'll get my contact information. Otherwise, you know where to find Thor and me. As Representative or Chair Garofalo noted, I'm darkening a lot of doors working on university matters. So you can find me anywhere in the building.
Thank you very much, and we'll share your contact information as well as Mr.
Thank you.
So next we have Mr. Black.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Can I ask, why do we always have these black and white? It's so hard to follow. Is there a rule here in the House chamber about color photographs, or is it testifying?
I don't know. I could direct it to staff. See what they say. I don't.
You're the chair. You're the, you know, that makes all the rules.
There's color on this side.
We have color.
You guys have color?
No, we did not. So, Mr. Black, while you're setting up your presentation, is it okay? Is it ready to go?
It needs power on or something. I don't know. I'm connected.
Okay. If we could have the House page help you out there. After the committee page, you want to help them get that up and running?
Whatever switch has to be turned
on. The wind must not be blowing.
And Mr. Chair,
if
we could have the handouts just on single side, we could cut down more trees up in my district, too.
Everyone's a joker today.
You're just making up
for last night. Yeah, no kidding. While we're setting this up, Mr. Horan, do you want to maybe come down and... If there's anything you could do to help me get back on time, I'd appreciate it. So, what did you just do?
I have no idea.
Keyboard and mouse. You're not going to say you're safe. You want me to go? So I'm working off of this one. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Horan, representing the Rural Electric Cooperatives. I'll start from page 2, the 7 cooperative principles, and I'll reference page numbers as we go. So a little bit from the past on co-ops. Co-ops are inherently self-help organizations. They were started by communities that, inside the communities that they served, by members of those communities because the market either couldn't or wouldn't serve those areas. It wasn't economic to do it. In a lot of ways, we're going back to the 1930s and 40s about why co-ops were started in the state. Every co-op in the state, regardless of it, if it's a 2,000-member co-op or 120,000-member co-op, is based on these seven cooperative principles, and you'll see these throughout how we do business, how we work, how we set rates, how we interact with our communities, what we do in our communities. We're more than just an electric service provider. Turning to the next page is the map. Minnesota is the second largest co-op state in the union after Texas. 45 distribution co-ops served by 6 generation and transmission co-ops. Like the municipals, we are not vertically integrated. We have distribution systems that provide direct service to the membership, and then we have generation and transmission cooperatives that generate and transmit that power and that are owned by the distribution co-ops. We serve, switching to the next page, page 4, we serve 85% of the state's geography, right around 2 million Minnesotans. Our cooperatives maintain 125,000 miles of line. That's transmission and distribution. About 100,000 of that is distribution. And I'll talk about that in the context of our rates, because that's a big deal. That amount of line that we own and operate, that infrastructure is a big difference, a big separator from the utilities you've heard and will hear from, and how co-ops do our business. What made co-op territory uneconomical 80 years ago in a lot of ways remains the same today. Rural Electrics also serve predominantly residential, and the reason I raise the residential issue is that residential consumers tend to be lower volume, poor load factor users, but they also obviously expect the same level of service, regardless of where they are in the state. That doesn't change. They still want reliable, affordable service wherever they are in the state. And so that creates a challenge for us, moving to the next page, and that's the main difference between electric cooperatives and the rest of the utilities you have heard from and will hear from, lower density. And that's how we differentiate utilities in this country is by, well, one of the ways we differentiate utilities in this country is by members or meters, really we would say meters per mile of line. And so when we say meters per mile of line, I actually mean physical electric interconnection points per mile of distribution line. So for cooperatives in the state of Minnesota, the average is 6. If you move outside of the 7-county metro area, you're at 3. Quite a few of our co-ops are in the 1 or even less than 1 member per mile of line. So the amount of infrastructure cost that goes into that mile of line is the same whether or not you're a co-op or you're a investor-owned utility or anything else. But obviously we have less members per mile of line, so a higher fixed cost, a higher infrastructure cost per member. They bear that differently than a member in a metro area or in a city. And in comparison, I pulled that out. For Minnesota, the investor-owned utilities have an average of 34 members or meters per mile of line, and municipals have an average of 48 meters per mile of line. So a significant difference of 48 to 6 for co-ops. And that lower density really does dictate everything else we do. And moving on to the next page, page 6, that it's that fixed cost that keeps the lights on. And this is the men and women, the poles and wires, the O&M, operation and maintenance cost, that keeps the system going. And so recovering that fixed cost is a significant issue for every utility in the country, and it continues to be a bigger issue as load growth flattens or decreases in a lot of areas. So people are using less electricity than they did 20 years ago. Our numbers at the residential level, at the distribution level, shows flatter declining load growth going forward. And so less energy sales. Distribution co-ops then tend to look more like service providers than commodity sellers. And so we're having to kind of change how we're talking about that. We're not in the business of necessarily selling you kilowatt hours, selling you energy. We're in the business of delivering energy. And so people need to, we try to start talking about that a little bit more. And we talk about that and how we price things, how the members and how each individual co-op prices and does their rate structure. And that's why it's a little tough to talk about co-op rates and how we would compare. And you saw that in some slides that were shared earlier. Whether it's a northern co-op or a southern co-op, what their density is in that specific co-op, whether it's a 2,000-member co-op or 120,000-member co-op, the rates are going to be different. How the rates are designed are going to be different. We talked a little bit about last night about delivery charges, monthly delivery charges. Those vary greatly, anywhere from $9 to in the $50, depending on where they are in the state, depending on what the demographic of the membership is. So how have we responded to that? Moving to the next page, what comes next? What's the future? Cooperatives have responded to the challenge of low density by looking to member choice, member options, and to minimize costs. As a member-owned organization, we survey regularly our members, and the top three things we hear from our membership is affordability, reliability. Those are the two big ones. They always come out. And options. They want options. So affordability and reliability, we're always looking at ways to reduce cost. And we're doing that through behavioral energy efficiency programs, traditional energy efficiency programs, community storage. And when I say community storage, I mean the most famous one for co-ops in Minnesota, because we lead on this nationwide, is hot water heaters, using electric hot water heaters to store energy overnight when the wind is blowing and the power is cheaper, and then dispatching them during the day when power costs are higher. It flattens our load, flattens the demand on the system, reduces the cost for the co-op, reduces cost for the member. So community storage programs, behavioral energy efficiency, EV charging programs, at-night EV charging, electric vehicle charging programs, saves money for the member, saves money for the co-op, helps us integrate electric vehicles onto the system. Community solar gardens, when you come into the option question. So probably this committee doesn't know this or hadn't really thought about it. We talk a lot about community solar gardens today, but the first two or three community solar gardens in the country were in Minnesota. They were started predominantly at the request, or entirely at the request, of member owners, right? Hennepin in the West Metro was one of the first utilities in the country, not just cooperatives, but first utilities in the country to create a community solar garden at the request of members. And not only have co-ops developed community solar gardens, but they're building them locally. Lake Region Cooperative used local talent, local know-how to build the community solar gardens at the request of the members. Some of the most innovative pricing schemes, investment schemes for the members, have come out of co-op community solar gardens. Steel Waseca in Owatonna, they have a program where you can buy a solar panel for $600, and they'll give you an electric water heater for free. So to try to, and that's actually at the time was the lowest price entry for a community solar garden in the country. So we continue to try to find ways to reduce the cost for the local member and provide those options they need. As inherently, and I'm moving on to the last page, but as inherently self-help organizations and member-owned organizations, we can do whatever the membership wants us to do. We need to provide that essential service. We need to keep power affordable and reliable. That is obviously what we have to do. It's part of the compact. But outside of that, we can provide whatever the membership needs and wants, and you will continue to see co-ops trying to find ways to do that. It's an exciting area to be in. This is an exciting state to be in energy policy, and I look forward to talking with this committee for years to come. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horan, and we'll include your contact information as we send out to members. Thank you very much. Mr. Black.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Black. I'm with Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I'll get right into these slides. They are in color. They're just far away from you, so sorry about that. But municipal utilities, we call ourselves public power. It's kind of a term that's gone back to the 40s and 50s, but generally, we are essential service providers, community-owned, nonprofit, public asset, and an investment. And of the 125 municipal utilities in Minnesota, 66 are governed by their city council and 59 by a public utilities commission, a local public utilities commission appointed by the local government. The benefits of municipal utilities here, several, that as the co-ops, we're also locally controlled and locally accountable. Part of the public community as a part of the city government, economic development partner. We contribute funds back to cities. We have reliable service, and we have very timely outage responses. Our energy services are tailored to meet local needs, and we provide local jobs. More on that in a moment. They're also able to take advantage of the mutual aid support network within the state. When there's disasters, no municipal utility is alone. They've got their brother and sister utilities to help them. We are affected by the same service standards, SIP program, RES, cold weather rule, certificate of need requirements that all other electric utilities in the state are subject to. However, there are also some laws that affect only the municipal utilities because we're public. We have open meetings laws, government data practices, public bidding requirements, and pay equity issues. There are 125 municipal electrics and 33 municipal gas utilities in Minnesota. And 49 of the 87 county seats happen to be municipally owned electric utility. Here they are, spread across the state. Nationwide, there are over 2,000 municipal electric utilities, and you'd be surprised, some of you, to know that Orlando, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Austin, Texas are actual municipal utilities. Minnesota, though, a municipal utility is generally a small quantity. 1,250 customers is a typical sized municipal electric utility in Minnesota. If you would like to compare that, here are some of the statistics on the actual energy side. A system with less than 2 megawatts, 25 utilities in the state, municipal utilities, under 2 megawatts in size, quite small. And if you get to the bottom, you're talking about communities that are generally under the state median income for a family of four. These are the largest and smallest municipal utilities in the state of Minnesota, from Rochester, which is almost three times larger than the next largest municipal utility, down to Little Wayland with 39 customers. If you want to compare to cooperative utility, about a fifth the size of a typical cooperative utility. And in fact, more than 50% of the municipal utilities are smaller than the smallest co-op. This is where Minnesotans are provided by municipal utilities. About 14% of the energy in Minnesota is provided by a municipal electric utility. And we get our power mostly, about 65%, from municipal power agencies. I'm going to talk a little bit more about those. But we also, some are supplied actually from a co-op, some from Minnesota Power, like Mr. McMillan just mentioned, and five others supplied by another investor-owned utility, Xcel or Otter Tail, and I believe maybe a Wisconsin IOU, formerly Alliant Energy, which moved out of Minnesota recently. These are Minnesota's municipal power agencies, the ones that serve the municipal utilities in the state. Some are not located here, but just across the border. These are where their members lie. Municipal power agency is made up of communities who have representative on the board of the power agency. The power agency generates or purchases the power that gets supplied to the communities through the transmission system. This is SMPA, Southern Minnesota, Northern Minnesota with 10 members, Compass, 12 members, MMPA, Minnesota Municipal Power Agency in the metro area. Missouri River Energy Services is headquartered in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Has 24 members in Minnesota. Heartland Consumer Power District, located in South Dakota as well. And getting right into the statistics, we're subject to the Renewable Energy Standard, poised to meet the next threshold of 20% by 2020. Where our renewable comes from, mostly large wind. These are some of the wind farms that serve municipal utilities in the state through these power agencies. We also have quite a bit of local wind power in smaller size. These communities own those in the green, the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency communities. Wilmer is its own owner of a wind turbine that you see pictured. Fairmont and Redwood Falls, and SMPA, Moorhead, and Worthington from Missouri River, and the rest here, Mountain Lake, Blue Earth, and a couple in North Dakota, actually. Municipal hydro has been a part of the municipal power supply for decades. I won't read through the list. You can see them there. These count as under the Renewable Energy Standard because they are so small. These are in the small 1 to 3 megawatt range. Missouri River Energy is building a medium-sized hydro plant in Mirpella, Iowa, and that will be operational hopefully next year. We're talking about 36 megawatts there. They're also looking at other opportunities in Minnesota for medium-scale hydro. But our large hydro is a significant amount of our power supply as well. 47 communities in Minnesota receive federal hydropower from the Missouri River dam system. And those allocations go back to the 40s and 50s. For some, it's 3% of their power. For some, it's as much as 90% of their power. Those are in very small communities, so it's not a huge amount. It's, but for them, it is a significant portion of their portfolio. Solar is increasing on our systems. We're up to 98 customer-owned PV systems among 125 utilities. Utility-scale power, here we're talking about 1 to 2 to 5 megawatts. Excel was talking about utility-scale being 100 to 500. To us, 1 to 5 is utility-scale, and it's the most economical. There are more under development, and there are community solar projects, one existing in Moorhead that's taking new subscriptions into a second 20 kW, and Rochester is under development on nearly 500 kW community solar. And other communities are looking at it and exploring the possibility as well. We also receive energy from biomass. This picture is from Le Sueur Agricultural Processing Plant, which has received national recognition. The Laurentian Energy Project burns wood in Hibbing in Virginia. Wilmer also explored with some corn cob co-firing, you know, something that a municipal utility can do as an innovative sort of incubator of technology experimentation. But you know, it's suspended for now. Maybe it'll come back again in the future. Landfill methane, wastewater methane, and municipal solid waste is also provides dispatchable renewable power for us. And there's quite a bit more distributed generation, customer-owned solar and wind coming onto our systems. Here are some statistics from, you know, about almost a doubling in a matter of a couple of years earlier in this decade. The future for our industry sector has a lot to do with workforce. We're losing managers to retirement. We're losing line workers to co-ops and investor-owned utilities. And secondly, non-utility energy sales or deregulation or retail retail competition. First of all, on the workforce retention, I mentioned managers, but also the line workers. We have issues that some don't. Generally because of our small size. I think of us as the Twins farm team. We lose them to the Yankees and the White Sox behind me pretty often. But we do a lot of the training. So
why the White Sox?
Well, I don't know. They were the next one that came to mind. It's kind of a municipal, I don't know, Minnesota Power. And this is where we do a lot of training of municipal line workers at our facility in Marshall. But we train them, we employ them, and then they move on to greener pastures. But great training for Minnesota employers and employees across the state. And next I mentioned non-utility energy sales is a growing possibility of a threat. We hear more and more about it. The problem is if you have someone come in who is not a utility, is not subject to all the regulation that Minnesota utilities are subject to, including municipals, they could come in and cherry-pick large industrial customers off of small municipal utility systems. And you can see that in these communities, you know, one customer can be half the load of the whole utility. And they've spent and invested and bonded for facilities to serve those customers. And if they were to go and take their power from somewhere else and eliminate the revenue that that utility needs to pay those bonds, those investments, those utilities are in, you know, their financial footing is absolutely swept out from under them. So that's a threat that it deserves some attention, and I just mentioned those reasons. And that's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Black. And, again, we will make sure to share your contact information. Thank you. We saved the best for last. Stacy Fuji from Great River Energy. Please state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will try and be brief. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Stacy Fuji. I'm with Great River Energy, and luckily for me, Mr. Horan covered a lot of things, so we can speed through. Great River Energy is a generation and transmission not-for-profit cooperative. We are owned by our 28 distribution member cooperatives, and what that means is Great River Energy exists solely for the benefit of our members. And put more simplistically, we own the power plants, we own the transmission lines. We don't have customers, per se. That's our distribution members. We are the second largest utility in the state of Minnesota. In your gray and even more gray maps on the right, you will see our service territory is sort of the dark gray. It's about two-thirds of the geographical area of the state of Minnesota. We provide energy to about 1.7 million consumers. To Representative Fabian's question, we own about 4,800 miles of transmission. In 2016, we paid $24 million in property taxes. The next slide, slide three, is a picture of our headquarters. If anybody wants to ever see it, we are located in Maple Grove, Minnesota. It is the first LEED Platinum building in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Horan talked about on the next slide, slide four, the comparison of utility types and how co-ops are different from other types of utilities. So as you see there, there's that comparison. We serve about seven members for every mile of transmission. And as you can also see sort of the breakdown of customer classes, we are a largely residential utility. About 60% of our members are residential customers. On the next slide, you'll see our generation resources. We own currently 12 power plants. Our three baseload coal-fired power plants are located in the state of North Dakota. However, as of May 1st of this year, we will be closing down Stanton Station, which is a 189-megawatt facility. It is a 50-year-old facility. It was not a decision that our board made lightly. It will be, in fact, the first coal plant in North Dakota to close down. In Minnesota, we have peaking plants. We have gas peaking plants. We have fuel oil. We do own a refuse-derived fuel or garbage burner facility located in Elk River, Minnesota. And then the next slide you'll see, backing up, we have wind contracts. Because we are a not-for-profit, we can't take advantage of tax credits. So all the wind that we have in our portfolio is under a PPA. In fact, I think recently it was announced in the papers, we have recently signed a deal for a 300-megawatt wind project to take the output from NextEra, and that will be located in North Dakota. On the next slide, like many members, a lot of our members are interested in solar. We have a number of solar projects, including some on our site of our headquarters. We have 19 projects located within our members' service territories. So we are also getting into solar as well, but it has to be in a way that works for our members. Mr. Horan talked about not being able to talk too much about comparisons of rates. So on the next slide, slide seven, for transparency purposes, you'll see that this is the average member rates for Great River Energy, and we publish that annually. So you can look on our website, and you will see what rates we charge to our members. Again, this is at the wholesale level. Over the next 10 years, we estimate that our average rate increases will be about 1.8%, and that's an average. As far as electricity prices, we can skim through that. Mr. Horan talked about a lot of the things that go into rates as to why we can't sort of compare one another. Again, so Great River Energy, while it is a big portion of our members' costs, it's not the sole thing. And so it's going to depend on who your distribution cooperative is to talk about rates. But what goes into rates, so it's a cost versus rates. So costs are the revenue requirements. Rates are the mechanism to recover those costs. And on the slide nine, you'll see what are the top drivers of costs. And there's a list going there. And as Mr. Clark and Mr. McMillan talked about, transmission is going to become a bigger part for us in terms of cost. As we have more distributed generation coming online, we have to maintain a system for reliability purposes. So you have to build robustness into the system via transmission lines. And so when something's not working, that it's seamless for people, you'll still have lights. So we will be making more and more investments in transmission as time goes on. Our billing units are sort of our top drivers of that. We're a residential utility, and so Great River Energy used to be the fastest growing utility in the state of Minnesota, and that was due to housing starts. And when the recession hit, we fell off a cliff, and that has not come back up. So we're still seeing sort of stalled residential growth. Energy efficiency, again, as a residentially heavy utility, can't buy an inefficient appliance anymore. Most people are changing out their light bulbs. Building codes are changing, so there's going to be a struggle to continue to meet the 1.5%. And members, so the 1.5% SIP goal is on our our distribution members, it's on retail sales. And so we aggregate for all of our members and we report to the Department of Commerce. There's a summary of what I've just talked about. And so finally, as far as what we see coming for future issues, so as I said, one of the big things for Great River Energy is we're not seeing the type of growth, so we're looking at things in the future in terms of how do we use electricity wisely. And one of the things that we've talked about and we continue to talk about is sort of this evolution for electric vehicles, of which the chair is a member, so he knows well about electric vehicles. We like the idea. We have a one-of-its-kind program for our EVs. It's called Revolt, and it's a great name. Our program allows members who buy an electric vehicle in our service territory. It was a way for us to raise awareness about electric vehicles and the good things about electric vehicles. So if you are a member of ours and you would like, we will retire enough renewable energy credits so that you are receiving a completely renewable supply of energy to charge your electric vehicles. Again, it helps us take wind off the system. It works as a storage component. We like that. And so in 2014, in Great River Energy's service territory, there are 211 electric vehicles. In 2016, there were 600 electric vehicles in our service territory. So it was a nice jump. Of that, about 157 of our members have voluntarily chosen to take on the Revolt program. The final thing we'll talk about is something that we're also very excited about in terms of electric vehicles is the notion of electric school buses. Again, so school buses provide for us sort of a constant, steady stream. Their routes are the exact same every day. They charge at night. So we're looking at a pilot program for both our metro, one of our metro co-ops as well as one of our rural co-ops because obviously the weather might be a little colder in Representative Lehman's area of the state or Representative Fabian's area of the state versus in the metro area. So we think that's a good thing for us to look at before we make any kind of heavy investments. And so that's it. If anyone has any questions, my contact information is on there as well.
Members, I want to first of all thank you to all our presenters for covering a lot of information, but I would hope that members take the opportunity to hold on to the information you were given today, to follow up either via email, phone call, or meetings with the resources we have available to us. Obviously, in the area of energy, lots of opportunities to learn, and so please use your opportunity as a legislator to meet with these very intelligent, very experienced individuals to gain that knowledge. Unless there's no other announcements, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, we've done a lot on energy, but we're also a jobs committee. And, you know, we have a lot of challenges looking at us, particularly in workforce training and workforce development. And I'm just wondering, you know, we've had, I think, four meetings and have all been concerned with energy. Are we going to kind of try to do the same?
I know.
Kind of a quid pro quo for jobs?
Well, you are correct, Representative Mahoney. We've had four committee hearings. You'll remember that the Department of Employment and Economic Development was here for the first committee hearing. The second committee hearing, we covered the Workforce Development Fund. We brought in some of those stakeholders. And then this third and fourth weeks, we're involved in energy. So far it's been 50-50. And I think as we go forward, you'll see us branching out into the other jurisdictions of this committee, the Housing Finance Agency, the Department of Labor and Industry. We'll be going out of that, and of course we'll be reviewing the governor's budget. So I think members should expect that we're going to have committee hearings in all the jurisdictions within this committee. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how should I say this? There's been a sense of a more in-depth look at energy than in what our future workforce is going to be. And seems how we're staring at a 20% reduction in our workforce, and that will be the only hindrance to our economy that, in my opinion, we should be looking at that pretty hard.
Well, Representative Mahoney, again, we've had four hearings. Two of them have been focused on workforce development and the deployment and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Well, they were.
You have to add in a lot of things to get to that workforce.
Well, so I look forward to suggestions from you and other members of your caucus on what we should on items that should be in our overviews and bill introductions going forward. Is there any other comments? Representative Clark.
Well, I guess I should also let you know, I did hear from the Commissioner of Housing. They're wondering about when they might be wanting to come aboard. So I want to make sure that we bring that up as well. And it's not just the Commissioner, but, you know, all the agencies, all the private sector folks that are working on that, too. So I understand your answer. I just wanted to make sure it gets on the record.
I believe I just said that we were having the We're reaching out to housing next week, but that's okay. Thank you, Representative Park. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We just heard about electric school buses. It's the first time I've heard about electric school buses in Minnesota. I know we do manufacture them here. Are we going to be talking about that more?
We may. Definitely a possibility. I mean, electrification of the motor vehicle fleets are... So I think there will be a lot of opportunities there, and I think if we are successful in getting the governor to sign our energy fund legislation, I think we'll be hearing a lot more about that. Any other comments or questions? With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.